also want to thank Father Reed, who graciously gave permission to speak here, as well as the Latin Mass steering board members that have so graciously worked so hard to bring me out here and get everything set up for this evening. So, just another couple of points to the books. They're on the table. The prices are marked on them mostly. I did take checks as well. I was going to say just be cautious when you handle them. Some of them are matte covers, and so after a piece of oils gathered up, and just so, you know, not to handle them too heavily, so you'll get a lot of fingerprints on them. So that was just the main point there. Everything from the press, which I run, it supports my family. It's a very small press. It's actually made up of myself, my wife, and one editor. And so we're busy mostly reprinting books as well as publishing translations that I or others do. So moving into tonight's talk, recently, about 2 months ago, I was in Rome, and I happened to be in the Palazzo Barberini, which was the family home of Pope Urban VIII, and it's now a state museum. And I happened to, I'd been there before, I hadn't seen a painting there, the original Holbein portrait of King Henry, right? And it's, you see the picture many, many times, but then when you see the actual painting, even though it's portraits, it's physical size is not quite gigantic. You see the brilliance of Holbein, and I'll point that out when we get to the painting in the course of the talks, that Henry is, you know, one of these figures where everyone knows who Henry VIII is. He's one of the most recognizable monarchs in European history. Everyone in every country can recognize his picture. Right? But for us, he's mostly the one whose size you remember, and his blood-stained attitude toward marriage. Other things. But we don't remember so much that there was a time where King Henry VIII was very young, he was very handsome, he was considered to be the most eligible monarch in all of Europe, and he married for love. It was described by contemporaries as motivated not for gold or jewels or riches, but virtue. This isn't the Henry VIII that I thought I knew. But understanding this younger, very pious Henry actually helps us to understand the various turns by which he comes to the tyrannical, bloodthirsty Henry at the end of his life. So we're going to begin looking at this. How did we get to 1535, August 6, 1535, where a woman rode across the River Thames to London Bridge and met there the executioner, daring, you know, by doing this, she could have been imprisoned and executed herself, but braving all of this to meet the executioner, pay him a little bit of money, and recover the head. The head was her father, St. Thomas More, and she was Margaret More, his daughter, his very beloved daughter, was a humanist, a scholar, fluent in Latin and Greek, and now was recovering her father's head. How did we get to that Henry? And that's where we're going to be moving to. So let's backtrack to 1491. Now this is a book of hours, very nicely illuminated in a city in Belgium called Bruges. And it belonged to a woman named Lady Margaret Beaufort. And she was Henry VIII's grandmother. Now in a book of hours, it's essentially a psalter. It's not too far different from a breviary. So it would be similar to the monastic hours, but simplified with the psalms so that members of the aristocracy could keep the hours, keep the psalms, various prayers and other things. And it also served as a sort of baby book and a record of events, almost like a journal. And down here, she scribbled a little bit about a certain event. So here she's recorded the birth of Henry. Okay, so hic die, she got the date wrong. We'll come back to that. Natus est Henricus octavus, creatus est princeps valis, patre suo Henricis septimo. So that is Henry created Prince of Wales by his father, born on this day. But it's curious, she got the date wrong. She starts writing at 15. Did she forget? Did she get it wrong? How do you get the birth of a king wrong? Well, the trick is, he wasn't important because Henry was not the heir. He was only the spare, as they say. His father, King Henry VII, and his mother was Elizabeth of York. They had come to the throne only a generation earlier. They put an end to Wars of the Roses, a very destructive conflict where the English aristocracy tore each other apart, trying to, whose noble houses pressed their claims, as the Yorkists did on the other side of the Lancastrians. So Henry VII, Henry Tudor, the son of Margaret of Beaufort, was related to the throne. He had fled France, came back with an army, and defeated Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. And the history is far more advanced and difficult than that, and we don't have the time tonight to cover it. But Henry had a very tenuous claim to the throne. And so he was married to Elizabeth of York, which solidified the two houses that had been warring for so long. It would bring about, hopefully, some peace. And instantly, seemingly, he had some sons. So the first was Arthur. The very name should give us a sense. The Tudors came from Wales. And Wales was the home of Arthurian legend. That's where the traditional legends of King Arthur were written and kept. And so the idea is kind of a reinvention of the monarchy of England and a grand Renaissance style. Now, Arthur was the heir, and whereas Henry was not, he was just a spare. So Arthur was taken to Ludlow Castle in Wales, where he was trained in everything necessary to be a king, in Latin, in statesmanship, and in warfare, and politics. But the more advanced educations at the time were thought to be unfit for a king. So he learned in this fashion, and his life was completely separate from his parents, and also from Henry. Henry, instead, was trained by his mother, and raised with his sisters, where he received a very simple education, but very good, and he reveled in romances, and also tales of knighthood, which we'll get to in a minute. Henry was also very pious, so this is what is called a bead roll, right? And the prayers that a young man would say would be kept up in this, and is still preserved in the British Library. And so you see various images. The ink is oxidized on the image of our Lord there, which is why it looks a little darker. And in here, various prayers, not unlike prayers we have, that we learn. So the very sum of medieval piety, praying prayers so that you won't be drowned, praying prayers for protection, of virtue, that you rule well, all the things tailored to Henry himself. And he's even annotated in a few places, asking his servant to say, to help him say his prayers, and he will pray for him. Closer to that. Okay, so Henry also is devoted to knighthood. He's raised on Portland, medieval tales of romance and knights, King Arthur also, other things. So this is where his mind is at as a youth. Okay? Just longing for that time. So very unlike a king. King's not allowed to act in this way, a young prince. Not very good for childhood development. But Henry very quickly is given the chance to realize his dreams, and unexpectedly, because in his youth, the first major challenge to Henry VII's throne comes in. Now, we mentioned the Wars of the Roses and Richard III, right? Richard III was generally considered a very tyrannical king, although there's another school of history that thinks he wasn't so bad. Now, when the king before him is his brother, Edward IV, and Edward IV also had an heir and a spare, young Edward and young Richard, and Edward died, and Richard became their guardian and protector. And quickly shunted the princes off to the Tower. And there, he had them, according to St. Thomas More, he had them smothered in the night, had them put to death. And then the princes were gone, declared to have died, and Richard had himself proclaimed king, which led to the final conflict leading at Bosworth. So the princes were gone. But should they return, they would be the legitimate heirs, not Henry VII or his sons. So the fellow on the left is named Perkin Warbeck. He was a Flemish model, actually, model for clothing. And he would model clothing for the merchants where they'd sell their wares. And so while he was in Wales, he happened to get noticed by several Yorkists who were very much opposed to the new king, Henry VII. And they remarked he has a bit of a, he looks a lot like one of the princes in the Tower. And so they started hatching their deception and got their forces in order to unseat Henry VII and place Warbeck on the throne. And so they proclaimed him Richard, the Duke of York. Right? And So in contradistinction to this, Henry is then made taken by his father and formally made a knight with the traditional vows of knighthood. He rides in on a horse in Westminster Cathedral. His father administers to him the traditional knightly oath, and now Henry is a true knight and a true Duke of York, being proclaimed so by his father. And just in time, Warbeck doesn't quite make it. He gets cut off at the Thames, and his forces are cut down. He ends up in the Tower. So that's the end of Perkin Warbeck. But Henry VII is going to be a little more careful and tax the aristocracy just a little more tyrannically, to make certain that there's nobody who's going to challenge his throne. So this is, Henry's education goes on, and then he starts to proceed and get best tutors from the continent, Renaissance tutors, to train him up and raise him. And so one of these comes to visit him, although it wasn't actually a formal tutor, but Henry becomes the patron of poets and Latinists from the continent, various writers who are recovering ancient texts, ancient wisdom. So this is on Henry's 8th birthday, 1499, and in front of him is a certain Thomas More. Now, Thomas More was from the London family. His father was a lawyer, John More, and he wanted Thomas to also become a lawyer at the bar. And More, though taking his law classes and studying, really was not interested much in law. He was rather interested in Greek and in Greek poetry. He devoted most of his life to Greek, which led to a good deal of tension with his father. But eventually he did take his degree at the bar and became a lawyer. But he never stopped being a humanist, and he had a very wide circle of friends. For example, Lord Mountjoy, okay, he was a student of the fellow over there on the right. And Grocyn, John Collett, the Dean of St. Paul's. John Collett is another one. He's a very interesting reformer. We always hear that, until Luther came along, nobody was reforming the church. And it's complete nonsense. And the people enjoyed repeating that. There were all kinds of reformers all around Europe already trying to work on reforming morals, law, and the fathers, bring back texts of the church fathers. And John Collett, who's a friend of Thomas More, the Dean of St. Paul's, and he even published a New Testament in English, which incorporated most of the New Testament as a guide for preachers, a book anybody could buy, so much for the church banning the Bible. Nevertheless, the fellow at the right was the most famous of all European humanists, Erasmus of Rotterdam. And Erasmus is someone that should not have existed. He was the son of a priest in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. So he was sent off to a monastery where he got an education, but he hated life in the monastery, so he fled when he was older, and made his way as a secretary of Latin letters for aristocracy. He was free. But he liked to live a little more lavishly than he could afford, so he needed to take on students, one of whom was Lord Mountjoy, who then related to him about all these great scholars in England, including young Master More. So More received Erasmus, and they became quick friends. And since he was going to meet the prince, brought Erasmus with him, with a present of poems dedicated specifically to Henry for his 8th birthday. Now, Erasmus relates in a letter that More brought him in, and he had no present to give to the prince, and was embarrassed by it. So at dinner, Henry wrote a curt little note in Latin, challenging Erasmus to bring him some poems. Right? So Erasmus spent the next couple of days trying to produce poems to give to Henry. Nevertheless, Erasmus would stay in England and go on to teach Greek at Oxford, and it was very much in More's circle. The two would have a very long friendship. Erasmus is a really interesting figure. There's just not enough time to talk more about him. We'll mention it here and there. So about the time that Henry reached the age of 11, his brother, Arthur, was then betrothed by his father to Catherine of Aragon, the youngest daughter of Queen Isabella and Ferdinand over on the left. And they shouldn't need very much introduction, but just in case. They are the two great Catholic monarchs of Spain who had finally restored the Spanish monarchy. They had restored all of Spain by defeating the Moors in Granada. They had funded Columbus, right, to go to the New World, which had brought them incredible wealth and made Spain the most important nation in Europe. But they didn't have any sons. Their one son died. And so Isabel and Ferdinand began marrying their daughters, fashioning European alliances, one of which will come very much into the story. So Catherine then was betrothed to young Arthur and married to him. And so Henry would have seen her at age 11 and thought she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. and led her up to the altar to give her away to his older brother, whom he barely knew. And thus began what was supposed to be the happy marriage, except 6 months later, Arthur was dead of unknown causes. So, everything now shifted. The shock of the death of Arthur brought Henry's mother into great sadness, and then she died in childbirth the next year. So Henry now has lost his older brother, and his mother was very much beloved, and he is now the heir, rather than the spare. Which is why the inscription in Lady Margaret Beaufort's Book of Hours we did earlier, she had gone back and it fixed this. Originally she wrote 15, because she was writing the entry, because on that date, he was created the Prince of Wales, when his older brother Arthur died, 1506. So, now, you know, she went to backdate it, but she meant to put in his birth, and she wrote 15, so she had to go back and fix it. Henry now had to get a kingly education, and that meant bringing his Latin up to par. So for this, King Henry VII brought in one of the preachers in his court, St. John Fisher, future St. John Fisher. Now, Fisher is an interesting story. He's born during the time of the Wars of the Roses in a place called Beverly. Blessed by geography, Beverly was a merchant town, and neither side of the Wars of the Roses could afford to alienate it. So John was able to grow up in relative peace, in spite of what the rest of the country was going through. And quickly, his father noticed how sharp he was, how intelligent he was, and began getting a savings to get him into school. Now, the schools in those times were usually monastic schools, and didn't cost very much. The schooling would begin with grammar. Grammar being Latin grammar. Latin is the language of all education. Latin is the language that you need in order to succeed in life. Logic is how to speak sensibly. So you learn your grammar, you learn how to talk, and logic teaches you how to speak sensibly and make correct arguments. And the last school is rhetoric, which teaches you how to sound very good while doing the other two. So with Fish, then you would move on to the quadrivium, art, music, natural science, arithmetic. Right? And so, in the natural sciences, usually being astronomy, principally. So Fisher became brilliant in all of these things. Meanwhile, his mother died. His father remarried, and the dowry allowed him to send Fisher to Cambridge, where he took his degrees and found a true vocation of priesthood. Not much more is really known about his life. There's little details that can be filled in from his sermons later in life and other recollections. But for the most part, that's his story. So while working for the university, after he'd taken his doctorate, he had managed to meet Lady Margaret Beaufort, the mother of Henry VII. Well, there's a map of Cambridge. I meant to go there. That's the medieval campus of Cambridge University. Okay. Lady Margaret Beaufort, as we mentioned, was Henry VII's mother. She was also very pious. She was technically a queen in her own right, but she stepped back in humility in order to allow Elizabeth Woodville to take her place as queen, although the two did not like each other at all. But she turned her attention to Mass, and she heard about 3 or 4 Masses a day, then devoting the rest of her time to reading the Imitation of Christ and translating it into French from the Latin and then into English, and then back and forth as a pious exercise. And she brought the first printers to England, a man named Caxton, and they printed the very first books in England and brought about the revolution of learning. The Renaissance was able to come to England through printing, largely because of her. She recognized as St. John Fisher a truly holy priest and a truly holy man. Many priests in those days were not so. They were careerists. It was Latin again at your door into a better life if you come from a lower place. And you have 2 options, the church or the state. Whichever one seems a better route to enrich you is the one you might go into. Likewise, bishops. Bishops are usually chosen because of royal favor, or they have some aristocratic connections. And the only qualification that they need to have is subservience to the king, usually. And the pope, for his part, didn't particularly care who became a bishop because of a certain tax called the annates, which meant the first year's income of the bishop would be sent to Rome, where it would go for the popes to pay for artists like Raphael and Michelangelo, which in itself, that part's not so bad. But this tax is horribly crippling, and it caused the problem that the popes didn't care who the kings made bishops. So this was a lot of the problem of corrupt souls. But Margaret Beaufort looked at the needs to reform the church, and one of the biggest ones was preaching, and Fisher was a brilliant preacher. There's a whole course, you can actually buy the book, I think Ignatius sells it, his exposition of the seven penitential psalms, which they modernized the English on it. But it's very, very good. Fisher uses a good number of allusions, classical allusions, that he makes simple for his audience who aren't learning. Most people in England could not read. And so the faithful would get their instruction through preaching, primarily. Now, a lot of the priests didn't preach well, and this was one of the big problems of the church on the eve of the Reformation. So Lady Margaret Beaufort looked to St. John Fisher in order to remedy it, and he did. So sent him around the country preaching, and he recruited a number of other preachers to the same purpose. Eventually, Henry VII also noticed Fisher's potential and how had a holy prelate he was. And he looked at his life. He was very miserly. He was, like you mentioned, he tyrannized the aristocracy with excessive taxes, spies, and random arrests in order to try to keep any chance that somebody would unseat him from the throne. But as he got older, he looked back at his life and realized he hadn't been a very good king. And so he hoped to remedy that by making a holy bishop with no connections at court, the bishop. And so he did. Now, Rochester was the smallest diocese at a time in England, and also the poorest, but it was the start for St. John Fisher's career. Fisher showed himself to be a model bishop. We'll talk about that more in the next segment. But he continued preaching to the people. Someone once said, but this isn't usually done, when he went out in the fields and assembled people there to preach. And his response was, if I do not preach to the people, I shall be damned. Again, another time during ecclesiastical convocations, Cardinal Wolsey, we'll mention a little bit, which attempts to throw around his power and get more money out of other clergy for state purposes, and try to advance unworthy prelates. And Fisher got up and declared, in the time of St. Paul, there were very few golden chalices, but there were many golden priests. Today we have plenty of golden chalices, but we don't have many golden priests. And eviscerated a lot of the lesser bishops that weren't doing their jobs. Fisher made sure to ordain all of his priests personally, only missing three of them. And he was quick to right any wrongs. If you heard a cleric was doing anything wrong, he would immediately punish him, put somebody else in his place. He would take care of his poorer clergy, something else many bishops weren't doing. So in all ways, he's the very model bishop. And that's one of the reasons when you hear the story of the Reformation, you don't hear much about John Fisher. He's been liquidated, use a modern term, because he doesn't fit the profile. Corrupt church on its way out. Oh, here comes Henry, bringing the Reformation alive in the church up again, as the official story goes. And then you have Fisher. See, More can be secularized. So you can talk about Thomas More on this whole road to the Reformation. He can be secularized and celebrated as this unfortunate casualty. But Fisher, well, you can't talk about him because he was the holiest bishop of Christendom at the time and recognized as such by contemporaries and by his successors. And what do you do with that? Get rid of him. And that's why until the 19th century, there was not even one good biography in English about St. John Fisher. And so, in 1509, Lady Margaret Beaufort died, and Fisher was brought in to preach her funeral. And if you find, you can find her funeral sermon, his funeral sermon for her online, and it's a wonderful sermon that evokes all the piety, the love that he saw in her soul, the love of God, and compared her to the lady in the Song of Songs, looking for her beloved, looking for Christ. But Henry VII died the same year. And then he preached a very different sermon. Cautious, on the one hand, but also attentive to the young prince, Henry, now king. Warning him, look back at all these ancient victories. He brings up Pompey and Caesar and other classical allusions to ancient kings who were very powerful. So where are they now? I don't see them. Do you see them? Where are their victories? They're not here. Look not to worldly glory, but to heavenly glory. Now, if this did make an impression on the young Henry, it didn't last very long, but nevertheless, these sermons made him one of the very best preachers in the kingdom. He's well known for it. So nevertheless, 1509, so Henry VII dies, and Henry VIII then becomes the new king. Now, when Arthur died, Henry VII wanted to continue the Spanish marriage, and then he got dispensations from Pope Julius II in order to marry Catherine to Henry, right? So a dispensation from the consanguinity, right? That is the kinship, because you couldn't marry your brother's widow normally. It was considered just too close to the kinship, even though you're not directly related by blood. So he needed a dispensation for that. and Julius II gave it. He also gave one to the Queen Isabella that was worded just a little bit differently, and we'll cover that in the next segment. But Henry then was told by his father to repudiate the marriage. Henry VII had a new idea. Maybe marry Henry off to a French princess or someone in the empire that is the Holy Roman Empire, someone else that might give him a little more prestige. So Catherine, sitting in England, she isn't able to learn English. She's in a foreign land. Her father has not paid her dowry from the first marriage, and she and her household staff stay on to volunteer to keep her alive, essentially. But then Henry comes in, and all the dragging and the red tape that his father had set up, he abolishes in 3 months, and marries the coronation, which begins in Westminster, where kings are crowned. Henry took the traditional coronation oath, declaring that he would protect and uphold the rights of the church, the independence of the church, and Magna Carta, which also keeps the same. And then, as they wind their way around London, they come to one of the London boroughs, to Cheapside. There was waiting the aforementioned Sir Thomas More. He's not a sir yet, he's not a knight yet. But he's also representing the London Merchants Guild. And he's an under-sheriff for one of the counties. And so he gets up, and so here on the right is a book that More composed and wrote in his own hand, copied out for Henry. It's the Ode to King Henry. And so he declares, as Henry winds around his procession, that now ends the reign of the Winter King. And here comes the end of our sorrows and the beginning of our freedom. For indeed the sun is now shining upon England, and Englishmen now shout out in joy, for truly we enter a new golden age, and a prince truly virtuous to lead the people there. He also stopped to praise Catherine and declare that she would raise many a son to be a worthy prince of this realm. Neither prediction would be true, but. So Henry becomes king, and now he really enjoys it. And so he's free from his father's overbearing control. First thing he does is giving out knighthoods, he's giving out lands, he enjoys truly making people happy. He loves his bride. He writes to Ferdinand, her father, King Ferdinand in Spain, telling him that she truly is a virtuous and worthy woman. If he was free, he would choose none other but her. He comes, breaks into the bridal chamber with his friends, playing Robin Hood. Another time, playing at night errands and singing for her and all things, all incredibly delightful. But there was one little cloud, governance. And to govern, he had to deal with his privy council, which is made up of his father inherited it from Henry VII, Bishop Warham, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Bishop Fox of Winchester, who was the Lord Privy Seal. So they kind of micromanaged the workings of state. Now Henry comes to the throne with one goal: to restart the Hundred Years' War with France, like his father, and not like his father, like his hero, Henry V, and win glory. This is really what he's looking for. And the Privy Council stops him in his tracks with their clergymen. They want peace. So what's the sense of all these wars? So what they use, their weapon to stop Henry from managing in ways they thought were unfit, is the course of the seals, which was developed by King Henry II in the Middle Ages. The course of the seals meant that when Henry would issue a document, for it to be legal, it would then have to pass to the Lord High Chancellor, Bishop Warham. He would make a copy and seal it with his seal, like unto that one. It's not the very same one, but it's the same type of seal. Then it would go to the Lord Privy Seal, who would like the seal a little bit larger, and he would make a copy and seal it, and then it became law. And they refused any orders or any movements toward war with France. So Henry was kind of put out. I didn't quite know what to do. And so he begins to act out like a child would against an overbearing parent. So he turns his attention to hunting, to fun. He's not allowed to joust either, so he has to kind of stand by at the tillyards, but he enjoys various parties. One of the things he sets himself to doing is composing music. So the right is a book from his reign, and a song, which I'm actually going to play, as it gets a little bit to where the direction he turns in.
Oh,
for let actually means hinder in early modern English. So it actually translates to, who is going to stop me? Certainly not you, Bishop Warham. Certainly not you, Bishop Fox. And thus he moves in that direction. He makes yet an older move. Joust. He was forbidden from jousting. As yet, he was king with no heir. If he should die in an accident, it would be put the realm in great confusion. So, Henry, with the friend, Nicholas Carew, the gentleman at the bedchamber, gets into armor, secretly without anyone knowing it, and participates in a joust. Now, some of his friends in on the secret see a knight fall and get afraid that it might be the king. So, rumors come and people start whispering, crying out, is the king dead? What happened? So, Henry takes off his helmet and reveals he's perfectly fine to great cheering from all around. Then some people start noticing, and one of the ones to notice was a certain Thomas Wolsey, who would become one of the most important figures of Henry's reign. Wolsey was the son of an Ipswich innkeeper who was usually on the wrong side of the law, and he knew the only way to escape it was to get himself into the monastic schools, where he was shown to be very brilliant, learned Latin very well, and entered church service. He was an almoner in Henry VII's reign and an assistant to Bishop Fox. The Privy Council had sent Wolsey to put the brakes on Henry to discourage him from wanting to go to war with France, to change his mind into more honorable pursuits. But Wolsey, when he witnesses what Henry does with the joust, he realizes two things. One, whoever helps the king gets what he wants will be rewarded, and two, Henry is just such a king that will reward very richly if you get him what he wants. So he sets down some legal paperwork and discovers the weak points of his Privy Council's resistance. The course of the seals is just convention. There's nothing in English law that can prevent a king from ordering his affairs the way he wants with just a decree. So they set it up. Henry appoints someone to a position in the government without undergoing the course of the seals. And Warham cries foul, this is illegal, you can't do it. And Henry sends in Wolsey. The reason is Henry is actually, for all his robustness and strength and his charisma, he's very non-confrontational, he gets very nervous, he stumbles on himself in an actual argument. You'll see this again and again in his life. So he'll send other minions to do his work for him. And this time it's Wolsey, who tells Warham bluntly that the course of the seals is just convention, and there's nothing that can be done in the face of the king's will. So Warham sends off a very angry letter to the other counselors and says some nasty things about Wolsey, but it goes through. Henry is now in charge, and Wolsey is the man that got him in charge. Warham is encouraged to resign, which he does in 1515. The war is on. Now, the war was taking place in Italy, principally, where European powers were fighting for who would have control of various Italian cities, where the Renaissance was in full swing, there was a lot of wealth to be made, and a lot of whoever commanded the best artists would have the most prestige, and would be the best prince around. And this begins with the League of Cambrai. So on the left, you have King Pope Julius II, who did not take his name after the early pope and martyr, but rather after Julius Caesar. Pope Julius II was a bull of a man, very warlike, a very careful political actor. Okay, he survived the reign of Alexander VI in exile in France. So he starts to have trouble with Venice, which is pictured in the middle here, as it was in about the 1600s. The Venetians had flouted papal authority in Venice, and they had also mistreated papal nuncios. They had violated clerical privilege, and so the Pope decided it was time for the Venetians to be taken down a notch. So he formed the League of Cambrai, France, Holy Roman Empire, Spain, Italian city-states, even England was encouraged to join, all to reduce Venice to rubble. And so the war goes on, and the French, after invading the Veneto, began invading papal territory, and Julius is enraged. The Venetians turn around and say, hat in hand, well, aren't they a little bit worse than us? We'll talk about clerical privilege. We'll start treating your nuncio as well. Let's just switch sides around a little bit here. And he does. So Pope Julius II changes the nature of the League of Cambrai as a holy war against France. And the best person of all to bring into it is Henry, who is just itching for the chance to get in the conflict. And so the Pope, doing doesn't really need to encourage it very much, sends him several barrels of wine and Italian cheese, gives him a break on olive, which is a papal export, but I'll mention that a little bit later, so mineral is very important, gives him a bunch free. And so Henry makes a league with his father-in-law, King Ferdinand, right now widowed, and they would together make France as Louis XII on the left, who's the King of France at the time. So Henry does marvelously in the north, right, with leads his army personally. He takes a city called Terouanne, and then another one named Tournai. Ferdinand, on the other hand, dithers in the south. He takes Nevers, right, takes a good portion of Nevers to be his own, makes a few incursions against the French, and then went home. Didn't really do very much. Henry, on the other hand, had distracted the French, caused them to pull out of Italy, and they lose very badly. And Louis XII sues for peace. Henry, at the Battle of Terouanne, for example, where he's besieging the city, the French cavalry rides in to save the people by trying to throw sides of bacon over the castle walls. The French, the English cavalry, send them in retreat so that the only thing that could be seen was the spurs of the French cavalry riding in away. And the English called it the Battle of the Spurs, so which the French did not like very much. So Henry gets very enraged against his father-in-law and, of course, his wife. Now, things had started out well. Catherine was pregnant. She had miscarried. Henry understood and then was patient. When he left to go to the war in France, he was with Catherine again. And when he came back, she was pregnant. And so things, good times, seemed to be rolling again. But then she miscarried again. And her father didn't really come to it, which is the whole dynastic reasoning of their marriage. And now Henry changes courses mentally. Less interested in his wife, and his first affair takes place with Elizabeth Blount, with whom he does have an illegitimate son, which is not good. He decides to switch gears, and I was already talking about that. This is actually a tapestry that Henry had made in the battle, and he made sure to seat the French ambassador so that they could be facing him, which they didn't care for very much either. I'm going to pass this up. So Henry begins moving around in different ways. Catherine, he regards a little less. And then he changes his mind, comes back repentant, and she eventually does have a daughter, Mary. We won't come into this narrative very much, unfortunately, but she's the only one of Catherine's children to survive. Henry then has a lot of thinking to do about his affairs. The biggest one is that the French expedition is enormously expensive. Tournai costs a great deal of money to maintain. He's building a tower there. The garrison there is very expensive. So he makes a deal with Louis XII, his enemy. And he says, how about I marry you, my sister, Mary. It's his sister, Mary Tudor. I'll marry her to you, and give me a cash payment, and I'll get out of France. I'll retreat back up to Calais. And then so it happens, and Louis XII then is now Henry's ally, which, again, makes Catherine, okay, what's going on here? Now I'm really in the dumps. Right, he just doesn't pay much attention to her anymore. Then Louis XII dies suddenly, and the new king comes to the throne, which we'll catch this on the next slide. But the new king, Francois I, is very powerful. He's a Renaissance prince. He's the one who brings Leonardo da Vinci to France, and he calls Henry's bluff. Henry declared that he was the arbiter of Europe, and if the king of France wishes to go to Italy, he will if I say so. Francis I says, well, all right. Let's see it, Henry. He goes to Italy, defeats the papal forces, makes a deal with Julius II, and comes back victorious. So Henry's got a lot of thinking to do about what his image in the world is going to be. In the meantime, an old childhood friend comes back into his circle. So Sir Thomas More had continued as a lawyer. He was the under-sheriff in Kent. He was a very important political figure globally, as well as the biggest humanist in London, one of the most well-regarded and the highest learning. This is a Leader family portrait from the 1530s. But he had set up his house there in London. It was very accessible. And he even made himself a small school with his children. And so over here is his daughter, Margaret, his beloved Meg. And unfortunately, she's kind of disappeared from the history. She's not spoken of so much. But she's very important, especially to much of his life. She's a very brilliant girl. More expected his son to be extremely learned, and his daughters ended up being far more learned than his son, who was just content to be a simple law clerk. He just wasn't that good at learning. And this was a revolutionary idea, educating women. Because in this time period, what is the even for aristocratic women? Well, why would you want to educate a woman? The arts of rhetoric are meant to be for speaking. And where do you do that? In a courtroom. Well, women can't go in there. Right? Women can't be lawyers. So, all right, well, you would learn Latin and learning and philosophy of ancient Greece and Rome. You'd learn that for education, but women couldn't be tutors. So what would a woman learn anything for, apart from sewing and brewing and general household tasks? And that's largely the thinking. More was more forward thinking. It was inspired by Plato in the Republic, where Plato speaks of educating men and women in kind. This inspires him to create this little school where they learn Latin, logic, rhetoric, but also Greek, ancient philosophy, and many of the greatest of Latin poets and Greek poets as well. And Margaret was brilliant in all of them. So she would come to be a great aid for him. When Erasmus would come to visit, they could speak in Latin very fluently. And More turned his attention to his philosophical pursuits. Utopia. This is one of the most famous books of More, sometimes More infamous too, because over the years communists have appealed to it and others, but that's not really what More is getting at. So utopia, literally in Greek, means nowhere, and has come into modern language as a word meaning like this artificial paradise of sorts. And you know, you can see a model a little bit of Plato's Republic, where he speaks of the ideal city. And for More, he postulates a fictional island called Utopia, which literally means nowhere, where all the inhabitants have come to the farthest point they can come by the light of natural reason, unaided by faith. And by doing this, he postulates a society that's goal is virtue. They're virtuous. And what do? They hold gold in contempt, so much so that they make urinals out of gold, but they never use it for money, and they never use it for honor and jewelry. They despise such things. The utopians instead speak of peace and war only to defend themselves. They have counselors who can tell a king the truth. And this is one of the things that More has been thinking about. How could a counselor tell the king what he needed to hear and not get killed for it? And so this is like a thought experiment, figuring out all of these measures, the ideal government, ideal state, how law should be performed, and other matters. And so it's a very influential book in those times along that line. And Margaret, of course, helps him very much in the production of Utopia. She also goes on herself to write a book. And this gets her into trouble later on. So she begins the translation of Erasmus's commentary on the Lord's Prayer, and then publishes it, which is something that's also unheard of. So she simply titles it A Devout Treatise upon the Pater Noster, made by a gentlewoman of good virtue and morals. And of course, the church throws an uproar. It's a work on theology. It has no license, no imprimatur, if you will. In those days, it was called facultas impressionis, that is the permission to print. And she didn't have that. So More had to run to Wolsey, who he was familiar with, and was growing in respect for the moment, until he's been a little better. And Wolsey licenses the work for the next edition, so that it gives the Moore's quite in trouble, just barely. But More comes into Henry's circle, actually, on a different occasion. So Julius II had died, and Pope Leo X, the first Medici Pope, right, comes to the throne of St. Peter, and his attitude is, we have gained the papacy, now let us enjoy it. And enjoy it he did. Not so much for the glory of Christendom, though. Nevertheless, the papacy sat on several mines of a mineral called alum. Alum is extremely important for cloth, clothing and dyeing. So when you dye various garments, especially very deep colors, after you wash them, they fade out. Alum, used it and soaked the fabric in it, it would make the dye stay in the fabric and seal it in so it wouldn't wash out so quickly, so these garments would last a lot longer. So it's extremely valuable, and the papal states has an absolute monopoly on it. So it has to be shipped around. Well, a shipment came into London. There were Italian merchants in London shipping it in, and the London guilds were very upset about this because they would bring it in and then they would trade it to other Italians in London. And the merchants guild in London felt the city management, they said, we own this. This is illegal. You can't do that. So they had a duke seize the shipment of all, quite a bit of it, about 5,000 pounds worth, which in that money is a lot more in our money today. Leo was upset, and he wanted a resolution brought about to him. So Henry and Wolsey had to tap Thomas More, which is a problem because More also belonged to the Merchants Guild and to the City Guild. And so they made him the translator for the Italian merchant. And this was problematic, so, you know, because he's got to report to the people on the other side of this. But he manages a settlement that he proposes to the judge out of court that it was just and everybody agreed with. So the city of London got what they wanted, Pope got what he wanted, and Henry and Wolsey got what they wanted, and so everybody was satisfied with the arrangement. So Henry said, this Moore fellow, we have to have him on our side. So he comes and visits, like in the famous scene in Man for All Seasons, join Team Henry. Now Moore was very nervous about this. Right? A few years later, he would write to his son-in-law, William Roper, who was telling him how wonderful it is your royal service. And he says, I tell you, son Roper, if my head would win him a castle of France, he would not fail to fall. Because as virtuous as Henry was, as joyful and as much mirth as he would portray, Moore could see that, and he knew Henry when he was young, too, that he wouldn't depart from his appetite over any particular thing. So you could see kind of the future Henry through the more jovial, happy-go-lucky Henry. So after debating on it, he realizes he could do some good, so he does, in the end, accept the role in Henry's Privy Council. Well, he wouldn't have had that chance. That's one thing in Man for All Seasons, he wears that the entire time. He only had that when he was Lord High Chancellor towards the end of his life. But nevertheless, so one of the things that Henry and Wolsey then set Moore to doing is negotiations. Francois I, the King of France, the new King of France, very powerful, has, humiliated Henry. So Henry needs a reason to be important on the European stage. And this becomes his very problem. He didn't have enough money for war. He was simply too poor compared to the other European monarchs. So what to do? So in working with Moore, they propose a peace conference. And Wolsey, who's the man that gets Henry everything, uses all his church contacts, and Francois warms to the idea. So they decide to set up a very great meeting in France. Right. And so, but the problem is that peace talks stall because a new player comes on the scene, even more powerful than Francois himself, that is the Emperor Charles V. Charles was the Duke of Burgundy, the son of Philip the Fair, and Juana, the oldest daughter of Isabella and Ferdinand, who would have been Catherine of Aragon's sister, older sister. So Charles is her nephew, and he inherits his father's rights as the Burgundy, which at those times wasn't part of France, it was a very powerful estate made up of French and Germans and Flemings and others. He also, because Philip the Fair had come into possession of the Flanders, which is Belgium and the Holland, in today's borders, roughly. So very powerful, very wealthy was Flanders. And so his ancestors had left it alone and just taken in, kept the taxes low, kept a little bit of money coming in, and it made them extremely wealthy. But because Isabella and Ferdinand had no heirs, they had made his father, Philip the heir, Philip the Fair, the heir to Spain. He died. So now it was to be Charles, who came down from Flanders to rule Spain in his own right as Carlos I. But that wasn't enough for him. So as the King of Spain, he held Sicily, and he also held Naples and Milan. But he decided to do one more. His grandfather was Maximilian I of the Holy Roman Empire, so he used Spanish gold to bribe the electors and fund his election as Holy Roman Emperor. What this functionally means is that Charles I of Spain, fifth of the empire, owns most of Europe except France and England. So Henry now is a less powerful but substantially powerful enough kingdom to sway the balance between the French and the empire. He would have to fight in which one. Meanwhile, Francois was trying to pacify Charles, at least neutralize him, and pursue this peace conference with Henry. So they established in Picardy a place called the Field of the Cloth of Gold, which was a wonderful display, like almost like a circus in today's terms. And there was jousting, and there was feasting, and great tents. The English outdid the French by setting up a temporary castle, which you see there. And you have Henry riding in the idyllic scene, with Wolsey and his train behind. And also in the group of St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher, as it came as the chaplain to Queen Catherine. Henry then, engaged in jousts against some of the best French knights, and likewise Francis against the English, and they all had a good time. In the end, they went and signed their peace accord, perpetual peace, and the Venetian ambassador remarks sardonically, these two men hate each other cordially. So 2 days later, Henry goes back to Calais, where he meets the Emperor Charles V, and they both agree to attack Francis the next year, so much for perpetual peace. But St. John Fisher also watched and observed the events, the only time he ever left the country, where he declared, "Our eye has seen many pleasures, many happy sights, wonderful things that have appeared and seemed unto us joyous and comfortable. But yet all these are but counterfeits, the true joys, all these were but dull and dark images of the perfect comfort which the blessed saints have now above the kingdom of heaven." He said this in a sermon to his congregation. Now Charles had pledged to join Henry and attack the French, but in Spain they weren't too happy. Their king was now an absentee monarch, and their hard-earned gold from the New World was flowing into Germany to fight the French. And this was not exactly what they had signed up for when they received him as their king. So many of the Spanish lords joined together and went to revolt, Almoneros, Brotherhood. And what they declared was that Juana, Charles's mother, should be the regent until a new king should be chosen. So the country divided, and Charles's forces were hard put because the bulk of his army was in the empire, ready to fight the French. So he shows up in London to meet Henry, hat in hand, the Holy Roman Empire, the most powerful monarch in Europe, and he can't get back to Spain across the Pyrenees because he can't cross French territory, he doesn't have the troops for it. So he meets with Henry. Now, one of the things that Henry had done was to found the Royal Navy, and he made a lot of innovations in English shipbuilding, which had made his navy superior to the French. So Charles comes, and he promises that Luna Catherine, long neglected, is brought back into the royal light, of course, because she's his aunt. And now she's involved in making decisions, something that had not happened for quite some time. And Charles comes to propose to offer Henry the moon. He will repay all the debts from Ferdinand. He will pay twice as much of what Henry's army costs are. He will, if only Henry will just give him passage over to Spain, and then the next year they'll attack France together. On top of that, Charles then promises to marry Henry's only daughter, future Mary the First. And so they're betrothed, and all these things are promised. He even promises to use his agent in Rome, Giulio de' Medici, to elect Cardinal Wolsey as Pope. And so Henry, they promised the moon. Henry must have had some skepticism, but he decides it's on, we're gonna do it. So he gives Charles passage over into Spain. Meanwhile, we mentioned earlier Ferdinand had taken the country of Navarre and taken a good portion. That's why today there's Spanish Basques and there's French Basques. And so they divided part of that country. Well, in the Spanish part was a city called Pamplona. And during this revolt, the Basques of Navarre took advantage of the confusion in Spain to declare their independence from Charles, and they brought in the French. And they struck at the main Spanish citadel, Pamplona, where a captain was encouraging the Spaniards to fight, they all wanted to retreat. The French breached the city, and he fought at the gates, and then he got his leg shot out from under him, and felt that the French were so impressed with the guy's bravery, they let him be taken back to his ancestral house in Loyola, and he became St. Ignatius of Loyola. Now you know the rest of the story, but it's not our story at the moment. So Charles promises all of this, and Henry takes the bait. So the next year, 1523, Henry goes into France, where not personally, but the Duke of Surrey defeats a major French army. It was within striking distance of Paris, and Charles never shows up. So he has to retreat. The next year, one of Francis's counts, Count Bourbon, he revolts against Francis, and Henry says, now's the time. He marches into France again, gets close to Paris, and Charles never materializes. So 1525 rolls around, Henry says, you know, this is just like Ferdinand. These Spaniards, he's not Spaniard properly, but anyway, you know, he's never gonna do anything. Forget all this. Next year, I'm sitting it out. Bad news. Next year is 1525, the Battle of Pavia. Charles V crushes Francois I's troops and takes the king prisoner, and Henry did not have an army in the field. So immediately, as soon as he gets news of the battle, he sends a message to Charles very quickly. Let us put an end to this accursed kingdom of France, the accursed Valois dynasty, and let us split the country between us. Let us partition France and finally have peace. But Charles did not want to create a powerful rival after getting rid of one. So he puts Francois in prison, and he writes back to Henry and says, if you want your chunk of France, come and get it. Humiliates Catherine. Unbelievable. We'll get back to that. So Henry manages all the money he can to get an army into the fields, and now France is for the taking, completely disorganized. Francois is in a prison in Spain. This is great, but they don't have enough money, so Henry calls Parliament, and the merchants resist him very heavily. St. Thomas More actually was chosen as the Speaker of the Commons in Parliament, even though he's part of Henry's Privy Council. He got down and begged for freedom of speech, because back in 1504, when he was part of the Parliament for Henry VII, he had spoken against Henry VII's taxation, and Henry VII was ready to pack More off to the Tower, except he died, right, a few years later, so it never got to that. But More remembered that and wanted to speak freely, so he asked Henry to grant that every member could speak freely without danger of incrimination in the Tower, and he did. So everyone got up and spoke about how they're not going to pay more taxes, because in those days, a king was expected to run the whole country on his own income. So whatever the king might pay for wine, for his servants, for himself, for his trinkets, for his jewelry, for his hunting trips, and for the business of state, for war, for whatever else, all that came out of his own purse, from the lands that the king personally possesses. So tax breaks were permanent, and tax increases were temporary, which is the exact inverse of today. Nevertheless, it was he didn't have enough money. He couldn't get the taxes, so Wolsey gets employed. Henry would issue a forced loan. All the nobility must pay him a forced loan. Forced loan is a kind of like forcing everyone to buy war bonds, essentially. You're going to pay me the money, and later, when I can, I'll pay you back. And again, nobody really wanted it, but he had not just resistance from the aristocracy, he also had resistance from the populace, which now were rising up in certain places and rioting. So Wolsey, spin doctor in chief, renamed it the Amicable Grant. Right? It was anything but amicable. So again, nothing doing. So Henry had to withdraw it and reluctantly accept that he was not going to make England great again in European affairs. And this just wasn't what he wanted. So Wolsey, though he did his best, just could not tame the war in France for Henry. And now Henry has to kind of step back, look inwardly, look at other factors. His wife, Catherine, has been horribly humiliated by her nephew. And again, the dynastic reasoning of their marriage was this union with the most powerful kings on earth, and that it failed to yield any real results. And by this time, being perpetually pregnant and failing as royal lady maker, because that's essentially what a queen was for many kings in this period, I'm not trying to be crass about it, this is simply how they viewed it. She's now worn out by being perpetually pregnant, and her young, youthful figure that Henry fell in love with is no longer there. So Henry's had various mistresses, and Catherine's never going to have children again by about 1525, right? She's just too old. About 42, she was older than Henry by 6 years. So whatever to do. So Henry begins looking inward. What is my future going to be? Where are we going to go? And how am I going to manage my household? And then he catches sight of a new woman in court who's been recently in the ambassadorial houses in France, Anne Boleyn, and that's where we're going to take up the next talk. So what we're going to do now is take a break, about 5 minutes or so. Everyone gets a chance to stretch, get some water, get some pizza if you want it, and then we'll pick up with the last talk, which will conclude this whole matter.